WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In 1984, when Reynolds Price was a third of the way into writing his sixth novel, Kate Vaden, he discovered he had a cancerous tumor in his spine. He went through surgery and radiation treatments, and 6 months after his initial diagnosis, he resumed work on the novel. Kate Vaden became his best-selling and most critically acclaimed work and won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Though Reynolds Price now has no use of his legs and gets around in a wheelchair, the last 5 years have been the most prolific period of his life. He's completed 4 novels, a book of poems, a collection of essays, 4 plays, and he's just written a new memoir titled Clear Pictures, First Loves, First Guides. Reynolds Price also teaches at Duke University. Price has spent most of his life in North Carolina, and most of his novels are set in the South. His former student, novelist Ann Tyler, wrote in Vanity Fair that Price's decision to make his home in the South has given his fiction roots. Any North Carolinian reading one of his novels must stop at least once per page to nod at the rightness of something a character says. Price's new book, Clear Pictures, is a memoir of his life from infancy up to age 21. In the introduction, he tells how his childhood memories opened up to him after he underwent hypnosis for pain relief.
I was having fairly severe back pain after 3 major spinal surgeries. The hypnosis was an attempt to help me relax even more than I'd been able to by any other method, such as biofeedback. Drugs had been of no use whatever. It only made me drowsy. The hypnosis really was a final attempt at deep relaxation. So it's the actual method of it simply was about a 15-minute monologue by my therapist, who was in the Department of Psychiatry at Duke University. And it was simply a sort of visual set of images bringing me down through clouds, through water, down lengthy corridors into a state of great relaxation, and then talking to me, talking to my mind about the visualization of those parts of my body which were in pain, and the attempt to project those parts outside my body and to cool that heat and pain down. It's extraordinarily effective, but we never worked at all in the hypnosis on memory regression, though that's one of the main uses of hypnosis, especially in psychiatry departments.
Why did you decide to not undergo the memory exercises? Because you were thinking of doing that.
Yeah, I was a bit suspicious, or superstitious is probably better, about tampering that for no really urgent reason with things that my mind might well have in its own wisdom decided to keep hidden. I think one of the major difficulties about memory regression is that one is likely to, one may uncover some repressed traumatic memory from childhood, and I felt none of the kind of present anxieties that would have recommended such a procedure. So I saw no reason to tamper with a mind that seemed pretty much at peace with itself at the time.
I thought the hypnotist gave you an interesting warning, which is that memories from childhood come back as you experienced it as a child.
Isn't that fascinating?
It really is, because it means it would be every bit as scary when it came back to you as an adult. You wouldn't have your adult perspective on it.
The noises would be overwhelming, and the sights would be very large indeed.
But what you found was, after the hypnosis helped you with pain, that you were getting flooded with memories.
Sort of parallel occurrence and a parallel delight was that as I worked more at home and away from the therapist, first working with a cassette recording of his voice, and then with my own concentration, I just began to find that great rooms of memory were being opened to me. Great files were being rolled out of my unconscious. And I actually began by getting back a lot of information about a boys' summer camp in the Smoky Mountains where I'd worked as a camp counselor when I was 20 years old, and in fact sat down fairly quickly and wrote a novel based on some of my experiences that summer, the summer of 1953. It was only after I'd done that that the number of family memories and memories of my own childhood that had begun also pouring in really convinced me that perhaps it was time to start writing down some of those memories. And as I began writing them, not really planning to write a book, each memory that I got seemed to bring forward even more memories. It was like sort of pulling on what turned out to be a fairly endless string.
Now, friends had urged you after your spinal cancer to sit down and write a memoir, and you resisted that for a long time. Why?
Well, I think the main reason was simply that I knew what they were saying was, you're dying, get it down in time. And since I was working very hard on not dying, on not obeying my doctors and those people who obviously felt that my time was extremely limited, I was concentrating very much on myself and my adversary, which was spinal cancer, and I wasn't about to cooperate to the extent of sort of making my last will and testament by laying out the story of my life.
So when you decided to write the memoir, did you just not see it in those terms?
Well, I was well past. I had long outlived my my prognosis and felt very strong and very full of energy, as I still do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt it was safe then to proceed, since I didn't suspect that it was going to be my last act above ground.
Did the surgery and radiation treatments remove all the cancer from your body?
That I don't know. Uh-huh. A cancer patient is a cancer person who's had cancer is like an alcoholic. We can only speak of a day at a time being in a state of recovery. It's a very interesting condition to be in for that reason. It's more than mildly risky. But I've always liked to have that sort of test pilot edge on my life. So once again, I've got it.
At the beginning of your memoir, you write about how you've really never kept journals for any long period of time during your life, and you found them to actually be self-defeating. I really liked what you had to say about this. As someone who's tried and failed to keep journals herself, I especially like what you said, that living through the day is sometimes hard enough. Who wants to, before going to bed at night, relive it?
All on paper.
Yeah. Right, and have to suffer through figuring out the right words to describe that day. And
I know. And I've just never been a sufficiently entranced narcissist to examine myself in that sort of pore-by-pore detail every day of my life.
Well, it's interesting, too. You said that you felt that writing a journal, in a way, made you more manipulative of yourself and of others.
Well, I think the few really devoted journal keepers that I've known, even though some of them are close old friends of mine, I've often felt that they were rigging certain events in certain ways simply because it would be good for the journal. They were asking me certain questions because they wanted to be able to race home and record my answers. So I haven't wanted to have that sense of my relations with friends or strangers, that I'm sort of asking X questions simply so that I can go home and jam it into my journal before I forget.
Novelist and essayist Reynolds Price is my guest, who's written a new memoir titled Clear Pictures. Well, let's talk a little bit about the experience of reliving your childhood. You make a very interesting observation, which is that even, you know, a normal childhood is filled with all kinds of terrors. And you have a paragraph about that I'd like for you to read.
None of the fears I met at 51, when my life was broken like a stick across some broad but unseen knee, and the fractured pieces were flung back into my numb hands to use as I could. No terror matched the childhood threats I've described. My guess is a great many people will grant the same, as the trials of age fly up in their road like actual demons whose harmless shadows we met and partly tamed in Halloween games. Any soul that endures a normal childhood, not to speak of the all but unthinkable innocence who lasts through torture at the hands of adults or disease or God, is made of strong stuff, a thing worth trusting thereafter in the dark.
What were the worst terrors of your childhood when you looked back on them?
Well, I think the worst terror of my early childhood, say from age 4 and 5 on into perhaps 8 or 9, was really the great fear that my father, who had been an alcoholic but was in recovery from the time I was about 3 years old, my greatest fear was that he would return to drinking. I had never seen him in any state of inebriation, and certainly never seen him actually take a drink. But I learned accidentally fairly early in my life that indeed he had had very serious problems, and being the very watchful child I was and being the only child in the house until I was 8, I was pretty concerned to be a kind of little temperance officer on the premises.
How would you do that?
Oh, monitoring very carefully what I saw when friends of my parents came over and brought bottles, hanging out as long as they'd let me, and then when time came to put little Reynolds to bed, feeling fairly miserable that I could no longer be in there, being quite certain that he wasn't drinking. Little did I know that he was very strong in his resolve, and that apparently he felt no temptation to drink in the presence of these cheerful friends after football games. But I didn't know that. Children know very little about the possibility of change in human life. They assume that any condition is permanent and cannot be altered, it seems to me. It's one of the desperate things about childhood.
Yeah, you make that point in your memoir, and I think it's a really interesting one. You say that you even wish that one of your trustworthy aunts would have tried to explain to you that time changes things and that you're not stuck in this condition, whatever the condition is at the moment, for the rest of your life. But I have to say that I think I had parents who tried to convince me of that, and it didn't work.
I think you're right. I still feel stuck. I think I even say that perhaps it wouldn't have worked. But children simply don't have the experience of time. They don't have any sense of perspective. And understandably, they feel absolutely trapped. What they are feeling at this moment is presumably what they're going to be feeling for the rest of their lives. I had enormously happy times in my childhood, and I suppose on balance, if I look back, I would have to say that I had a serene and lovely childhood, but that's not to cover the fact that there were very bad moments indeed, and all of them I've at least tried to be honest about in this memoir.
I want to read the very first sentence of your memoir. You write, "One of the stranger days of my life came in March 1987, when I passed the age at which my father died. He lived for 54 years. What was the significance of being older than your father was when he died?
Well, Freud said, and I go on in that same passage to say that Freud said the most important day of a man's life is the day of his father's death. It certainly was the most important day of my life in the sense of letting me see in a kind of blinding suddenness that I was now the next man in line in our family, that life now was a thoroughly serious matter, that there were no backstops behind me, there were no safety nets under me, as indeed there proved not to be. I loved him tremendously, and our relations had been intimate, though marked by a peculiar kind of Victorian formality. But at the time of his death, I simply realized I was a man, and he had awarded me that knowledge by essentially insisting that I preside over the awful last days of his life.
I want to have you read another section, and this is a section where your father has a brain tumor, and he's about to be wheeled in for surgery, and you're with him during those last moments before the operation. Would you read that section?
Yes, it's actually it's lung cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
"Anyone who's undergone radical surgery or seen a friend through it will supply here the desert clarity of the stale air that fills a room in those last private minutes. If the patient knows that his condition is grave, that his hopes are severely limited, then both he and you are visible in your dire helplessness as never before. You hang in a narrow space with miles of distance between him and you, and you meet each other's eyes like partners in a killing, or victims about to be shot at the edge of a ditch they've made you dig all night. No firing squad can thrust you out of warmth and safety onto the windy ledges of mortality quicker than the arrival of two orderlies in surgical green with a rolling stretcher. The patient is either trying to pray or is grappling in silence with doubts, real fears, and the need to show heroic calm. The friend is also trying his version of similar needs, and the line dividing the two is paper thin. One is the victim. Today, the friend is wild with a thanks he must not show, a thanks that freezes if he's realistic and knows he's next. Then, before you've mastered your face and voice, the orderlies start their urgent work. Your last exchanges lapse into code. Never goodbye or thanks, but empty promises of meeting. I'll be right here when the ether wears off. Don't give away any state secrets now. The patient remembers the wedding ring he's forgot to take off. He hands it to you. You wear it for safety. Then the stretcher rolls, and at last you see with scalding newness how near to lost any loved one is, racked out flat under taut white sheets, how lost you'll be when your day comes.
You've really been on both sides of that scene. You've been the son with his father when the father was about to undergo surgery, and then you've been the person having surgery yourself when you had the spinal operations for the tumor. Did you feel like you were able to handle either side of that with more grace?
Well, obviously, if I had to take my choice again, I'd still prefer to be the person who's not on the table. I think it's what I tried to suggest in the passage, and it's one of the grimmer passages in the book, obviously. I hope readers won't, or potential readers won't think that the book is made up entirely of such awful moments. I just think that at such moments, a sort of courage takes over in the vast majority of human beings. Certainly a sense of inevitability takes over. One of the major things that hospital personnel know how to do, perhaps unconsciously, is to convert one into a passive victim fairly rapidly. And there's nothing to do but simply be rolled ahead to face whatever comes. In my case, I was very lucky, and degrees of healing and long years of work were the result of those awful moments. In my father's case, unfortunately, he was dead within about 5 days.
Your father died 5 days after his surgery. When you had your first spinal operation?
Yes.
Did you think you were going to survive it?
I did. I don't think I seriously considered the possibility, though that was part of the surgeon's warning, as it generally is before any serious surgery. But I did not feel that I would die on the table.
Can I ask you the kind of half-empty, half-full type question? When you survived the operations and ended up a paraplegic, but ended up with energy, alive, and with I think a pretty good prognosis, did you feel really angry or lucky?
No, I don't feel angry at all. In fact, doctors kept telling me I was supposed to feel angry. Get the anger out of your system. But who was I supposed to be angry at? Cancer? No one was responsible that I could possibly see, and I certainly don't feel responsible myself. It was perhaps a gift from my genes, but in any case, the results in my life have been, without wanting to sound revoltingly sentimental about it, the results have been very far from tragic. My work has increased in quantity fairly dramatically, and I like the work that I've done in recent years as much, if not more, than the work I'd done before. I've also, I think, acquired kinds of readers and respondents to my work that I hadn't reached before. Certainly my friends have responded with wonderful, sane attentiveness, and I spend probably under 30 seconds a week feeling self-pitying or longing for some earlier physical state.
Well, that's sure far less than your average person.
Yeah, it occurred to me the other day, a friend was talking about giving up smoking, and she'd done so 6 months before, but still longed for cigarettes. And I suddenly realized what I hadn't thought about, that I have not longed to be able to stand up and take a step for perhaps 3 years now. It simply doesn't occur to me. I'm someone who lives by sitting down, and that's my normal state now.
Well, this has really been your most prolific period. Have your writing habits been affected by having to sit in a wheelchair?
Well, I've had a great many errands and little thieves of time removed from my life by a very helpful assistant who does things like buying the groceries and getting the laundry. So an enormous amount of the very consuming busy work that we do in our daily lives has simply been removed from my calendar. I hadn't realized how much energy leaks away in that sort of lemming pursuit, that sort of little rats in maze pursuit of going about getting the little chores of daily life done. So I really basically write now for somewhere upwards of 6 to 9 hours a day, and I love doing it.
I want to get back to something you say in your memoir that may be applicable here. You've always, well, I don't know what the word to use, if religious is the right word or not, but you've always had deep spiritual beliefs. And you write that you're really baffled by so many people's indifference to religion, that you just can't understand how they wouldn't spend more time thinking about it and, you know, thinking about spiritual issues.
Well, obviously, I just feel that the world around us in each of its aspects, from the tiniest single-cell organism to the most complicated mammal of a whale or an elephant, is so immensely, mysteriously, and elaborately and contingently made that it seems to me utterly phenomenal. And if I have to say even further, it seems to be stupid in the nth degree that there are any human beings at all who don't at least trouble themselves to consider the mysteries of the organization of live and inorganic matter. And those considerations have always led me, at least, to a sense of organization, a sense of meaning. I certainly don't prescribe my own findings for anyone else, but they've been very vital in my own ongoing life and in my understanding of the life that I watch around me.
How important is going to church?
Going to church is not important to my life. I grew up in Christian Protestant churches, but have not been an active member of a church for about 30 years now.
So it's a more personal sense of religion.
Yes, but it's fairly orthodox Christianity. As a matter of fact, I just haven't felt the need in my life for regular church attendance.
Mm-hmm. Writer Reynolds Price is my guest, and he's written a memoir called Clear Pictures. You say in your memoir that your aim is to go on being a picture maker, and that's something that you've done almost all your life, either drawing or writing, because you used to draw even before you wrote. And you ask the question, why is it that people spend so much time copying their worlds? And I think it's a really important question, and a question that certainly gets to the what makes art important type of question. What are your answers to it?
It is very strange, isn't it? As far as we can see, no other mammal even attempts to copy his visible world. All organic creatures at least copy themselves in physical offspring, in children or baby whales or whatever. But we're the creature who draws pictures of other creatures, and pictures of sunsets and trees and bison. I essentially have no idea why we do it. I'm absolutely fascinated, and I feel very compelled by it. I'm also aware that if you set up your easel on the boardwalk or in a park and start drawing the face of the nearest child, you'll draw a crowd as quickly as anyone pursuing any other activity in the park. Human beings are fascinated by those people who have the ability to portray the world recognizably. The only thing I can hope to offer, and it's almost a cliche of an answer, is simply that we have at least a temporary sense of controlling reality, if indeed we can look at it closely enough to transfer its lines onto paper.
I just want to ask you a question about pain. Earlier you were describing the hypnosis mm-hmm. that you use to help with pain, and that seemed really effective. Do you still have pain problems now?
I have a fair amount of pain. I must say the hypnosis and biofeedback have really, in the closeness with which they resemble Oriental techniques of meditation, they've really helped me to accept the pain as an ongoing condition of my life, which is as real as the fact that I lose X number of gray hairs a day and when I shower. It's simply there, but it doesn't frighten me or threaten me as it had done earlier, which obviously we're taught. I mean, One of the purposes of pain is to warn us that something terrible is going on. In my case, almost all my pain is phantom pain. It's pain coming from legs that, in fact, can no longer move. So the real problem is getting my brain to turn off those alarm circuits now that the fire is essentially out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the pain of the old vet, you know, who lost his leg at Gettysburg, but still his right toe still itches because his brain tells him that something's wrong down there in that long absent leg.
I've read the first sentence of your memoir out loud, and I think I'd like to close by reading your last two sentences out loud. You write, "With age, I'd hoped for the gift to be simple. At the age I am now, this is what came." Tell us why you always wanted to, what you mean in the sense of writing of the gift to be simple and why you wanted that.
The gift to be simple is a famous Quaker hymn. Most people probably know it in Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. I from the earliest adult reading that I did in my life of people like Milton and Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Goethe, etc., I certainly became aware that a certain kind of genius, not American geniuses, by the way, but generally European and Oriental geniuses, have done their greatest work when they were old men and or old women, and the power and clarity and lucidity and simplicity of that work had always lured me as a hope that I might get there. I think what I mean at the end of the memoir is that really I continue to hope right to the end of the book and afterward, now that it's available to the eyes of readers, I continue to hope that it's as clear and as simple as I could possibly make it and remain true to the richness and mystery of the beings and actions that I was trying to describe.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about writing in your life. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.